are going to discuss what we know so far about the Trump administration's first federal budget. We did get some clues this week. President Trump says he wants to increase defense spending by $54 billion while sharply cutting domestic programs and foreign aid. So how does that sit with you? I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It is 8.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Thursday, March 2nd. We are going to welcome in a budget analyst from the group Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget to discuss what we know so far about the Trump administration's first federal budget and whether these numbers match up. We'll welcome your questions and views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So will this work? Can we increase defense spending by 10% or $54 billion and pay for that by cutting domestic spending? What about this $1 trillion plan for new infrastructure projects? Where's that $1 trillion going to come from? And how about tax cuts? Can there be massive tax cuts while all this is happening, too? What do you think? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on this morning.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. First off, what is the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget?
Yeah, so we are a nonpartisan, we're called a think tank, but we're basically a nonpartisan study group that's based in Washington, D.C. And we do a couple of things, but mainly we study and we analyze, we write on, and we advise policymakers on anything related to the budget. That includes tax policy, that includes defense policy, Social Security, and we're completely nonpartisan. We are represented by both Democrats and Republicans. But we do believe that Washington needs to get back to fiscal responsibility.
Yeah. And what does a broad definition of fiscal responsibility?
Well, look, it means basically take what you need and pay for it, right? It doesn't mean that spending has to go down to zero. It doesn't mean that taxes have to go to 100. But you can't have a huge wedge between how much we're spending and how much we're taxing. We need to be realistic about what we can afford.
Mm-hmm. Well, we did learn a little bit more this week about President Trump's priorities, fiscal priorities, primarily in terms of defense. He had some other things to say, but talk in general about this 10% increase in defense spending, $54 billion. Can we afford that?
Well, I think there's some important context here, which is that for the past few years, we've been living sort of with this sequestration. Right back in 2011, we agreed that we were going to get deficit reduction done, and if we didn't, we were going to let these across-the-board cuts hit defense and non-defense. And these were across-the-board cuts of about 10% of the defense budget. And then we couldn't come up with that deal. So we've been living in a sequestration world, but we've been fixing it, partially fixing it a couple of years at a time. So this year, for example, our spending is about $30 billion above sequestration. That sequester is expected to come back next year in full, which means that full 10% cut to the Defense Department is going to go into effect. And what Donald Trump is proposing is 100% reversal. Now, that's not nuts. That's actually taking defense to where we thought it was going to be in 2011. But it's also not cheap. And to think that we can pay for it all with that small sliver of the budget that we call non-defense discretionary is a little silly.
That means that we can't cut domestic programs and foreign aid enough to pay for that.
You know, I'm really skeptical because we're also living with sequestration on the non-defense side, okay? And that total non-defense side is 15% of our budget. When you take out veterans and Homeland Security, which I know the president doesn't want to touch, it's more like 12% of our budget. And that's the core functions of what we do. That's a federal workforce. It's all the buildings here in Washington, D.C. and around the country that are federally owned. It's our Department of Education. It's our Department of Agriculture. It's our Department of State. So, of course, there's waste throughout government, and we should find it wherever we can. But I'm worried about being able to find another 10% off of the existing sequestration cuts to that small sliver of the budget.
So then what? What happens? I mean, if the administration determines that we should have this 10% increase in defense spending, and there isn't enough to cut away from domestic spending, what has to happen?
Well, I think we can do what we've done the last 2 years, which is, first of all, maybe we can't get the full 10% defense hike, but we can get a portion of it. And right, he's proposed $54 billion. If we got $30 billion or $40 billion, I think that would be enough for the Department of Defense to do what it needs to do. So that would help us on the cost end. On the savings end, some could come from non-defense discretionary, but we could also open up the entire rest of the budget, the mandatory budget, and use that to find savings. This is what we did the last two times we bumped up defense and non-defense to pay for the sequester. We looked at the mandatory budget, programs like Medicare and Medicaid and food stamps and federal employment and farm subsidies. There's a whole world of spending out there that's not even being discussed right now.
I know cutting foreign aid is also one of the things that he has proposed. It's actually a 37% cut to the State Department and foreign aid to help pay for the new defense spending. What about that?
You know, I think Senator Marco Rubio of Florida had a really good, actually, tweet on Twitter about this, and he said, foreign aid isn't charity, and so we shouldn't be making sure what we're doing is always in our national interest. But foreign aid is also necessary for our national interest. So I think some cuts to foreign aid maybe would make sense. It doesn't seem like there's the political will to do this level of cut, and I'm not sure it would be wise to do anyway. Also, let's remember, foreign aid is 1% of our entire federal budget, just 1%.
Yeah. So in general, how are you feeling about the direction that President Trump is taking, at least with the very bare bones ideas that we have about the first federal budget?
Yeah. Well, I think it's more reasonable than I think many of my colleagues that there would be this defense bump up. I think it's reasonable to look at the Defense Department and realize that we probably can't live at these sequestration levels. But I'm very worried that there's no discussion of any of our largest government programs. Our three largest government programs are Social Security, Medicare, and Defense. Our three fastest government programs are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. There's been no discussion of touching any of these programs, and that's where all the money is.
Yeah. Well, President Trump promised during the campaign that he wasn't going to touch those programs. So why does that bother you?
Well, it bothered me during the campaign, too, because the numbers don't add up. During the campaign, President Trump said he was going to balance the budget, he was going to cut taxes, he was going to increase infrastructure and defense, and he was going to do so without touching any of these programs. There's, you know, I didn't get my PhD in mathematics, but it doesn't take a genius to know that if you take half the budget off of the table, you cut your tax base way down and you increase infrastructure by $1 trillion, you're not going to be able to balance the budget. Some of these things have to give.
But people like, I'm approaching retirement age, and I don't want Social Security and Medicare to be changed right when I'm ready to start collecting. people love these programs. They count on these programs. They need these programs. They don't want them cut.
So I would look at Social Security and Medicare a little bit differently. Because for Medicare, there's still so much opportunity for us to deliver better or as good health care at a cheaper price. We're just beginning this move to a new way of paying for care, where instead of just giving hospitals and physicians money for each service, we give them money based on outcomes. And so I think there's a lot of money to be added in Medicare just by improving the incentives, just by improving the delivery system, just by improving the benefit design. So I think we can actually save a lot of money in Medicare without you necessarily paying much more out of pocket, and in some cases, with you paying less out of pocket. Social Security, look, we look at this over a 75-year window. That's how we try to make the program solvent. The problem is it's 17 years from going bust, okay? When my daughter is going to be born this year, by the time she's 17, there's going to be no Social Security trust fund, and the benefits are going to be cut across the board 21%. So instead of allowing the Social Security trust fund to go bust, what we can do is make gradual, thoughtful changes mostly, if not entirely, apply to new beneficiaries and are phased in slowly. And if we do that starting today, You know, people that are in their 30s and their 40s can start to plan and adjust a little bit. People that are in their 20s can start rethinking a little bit how much they're going to get from Social Security. And by the way, we can do this in a way where the people that count on the program the most are going to get the same or even higher benefits, whereas the folks that don't need it as much can start to adjust to having more of their own savings and more of their own work to supplement Social Security.
Well, we'll see if our listeners have any questions on that. Do you think that Social Security and Medicare should be on the table when it comes to the next federal budget? What reforms would you tolerate or favor? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We are talking with Mark Goldwine, who is a Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And we're talking about the first Trump administration budget plan and wondering what you think of it, too, or what questions you have. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Just before our news break, we were talking about Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And President Trump did not mention anything in his speech before Congress about those programs. And as we mentioned in the past, he has said he would not propose any changes and would not touch those programs, which you, Mark pointed out, what, they account for half of total spending?
That's right.
So you want these programs touched because you say they are headed for insolvency. But let's clarify a little bit about what you mean by reforming these programs. Are we talking about Paul Ryan's plan to maybe semi-privatize both of them?
I don't think Paul Ryan used to have a plan of privatized Social Security. That was a long time ago. As for Medicare, I don't think any kind of privatization is necessary. I do think something we should consider is whether we want to let the existing private plans that, you know, offer your Medicare Advantage, let them compete a little more directly with traditional Medicare, keeping the choice for people to have either. But this isn't necessary at all to reform these programs. I think the biggest thing we can do is find a way to deliver the care more efficiently. And we're already starting to do this. We're already starting to pay providers more based on the quality of what they give us, not just the quantity of care. That's the first starting point in Medicare.
Very briefly, why is paying providers more going to help solvency of Medicare?
So it's not paying them more. It's paying them differently. Okay. Right now, here's how it works. The more tests a doctor or hospital orders, the more procedures they give you, the more money they get paid. Right. So their incentives are to keep you there as long as possible, to give you as many tests, as many procedures, et cetera. If instead we said Medicare is going to pay them for the disease, for the incident, for the injury, and they should try to cure it and treat it in the most efficient way possible, that would save money. If we further said, then we're going to give you bonuses if you do a good job, and we're going to reduce your payment if you do a bad job, that would save them more money. That would save us money and increase quality of care. So this is actually already the direction that healthcare is moving, but Medicare is the biggest single provider of healthcare, the biggest single buyer of healthcare, and so it needs to continue to lead the way.
So then, I don't have all the details of Congressman Ryan's plan, but it was something along the lines of giving citizens vouchers to pay for their Medicare health expenses. You don't think that kind of a change is needed?
I don't think that anything like that is needed. I do think The more recent versions of Ryan's plan no longer do a voucher. What they now do is they allow private companies to compete directly with Medicare, with traditional Medicare, and you get a subsidy based on kind of the lowest cost or the near lowest cost plan. It's actually similar to what we do with Obamacare. I think that's reasonable to consider, but I think it's absolutely not necessary to secure Medicare. There are many things we can do to make Medicare solvent and sustainable without having to bring in private plans.
So how do we make Social Security solvent?
All right, so Social Security is a little tougher because there's no free lunches like in Medicare. There's no pure win-wins. But we still have a long time horizon. We still have 17 years until the trust fund runs out. And I think we can do an all-of-the-above approach that gets us there gradually, efficiently, and in a targeted way. I worked on the Simpson-Bowles Fiscal Commission, and we proposed a variety of options that together got to solvency. For example, and I know this is controversial, we raised the age, but we indexed it to life expectancy, which meant the age only grew when life expectancy grew. And actually, that meant that by 2075, the age would go from 67 to 69. So it's a two-year increase over the next 60 years. I think that's enough time for seniors to plan and adjust. We also changed the benefit formula to say benefits are going to keep growing for low earners. In fact, they're going to grow a little bit faster. They're going to grow at slightly slower but about the same pace for the average earners. But for the higher earners, we need to slow the growth of benefits over time because we can't afford to keep having benefits that grow with wages when our tax base is growing more slowly. And then we said that savings got us part of the way, but it's not enough. So we need more tax revenue into the program. Now, right now, people pay their Social Security payroll tax on their first about $130,000 of income. We said let's gradually bump that up to over time to more like $250,000. So people are paying taxes on a little more of their of their income. The combination of those three changes got us most of the way there. And then we just did, you know, little puts and takes to get us the remainder.
Yeah. So some are worried, some Democrats are worried that because President Trump in his speech on this week's didn't say leave Social Security and Medicare alone, that he might be open to changes. What do you think?
Well, I think that President Trump may be open to changes on Medicare. His position on that has always been kind of a little more cagey. On Social Security, he seemed to be pretty firm. He doesn't want to touch it. And I should repeat, I think that's completely backwards. You know, the only thing he talked about on Social Security was getting rid of fraud from seniors that are, 106-year-olds and are actually not alive but collecting benefits. We looked at this, and if you got rid of all of the fraud in the Social Security program, and of course nobody knows how to get rid of all of the fraud, but if somehow you could, it would close only 3% of the solvency gap. So you have to make changes to Social Security. It's just a question of if you want to do them now and make them gradual with a lot of lead time, or if we want to wait until the program is on the verge of insolvency and make some drastic and unfortunate changes.
We are talking with Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, talking about the first Trump administration budget. We had some hints as to what it will entail this week. We have many callers, so let's go to Lenora in La Crosse first. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. The points that I was calling to make, Medicare is already an extraordinarily lean program and the most efficiently run healthcare system or healthcare delivery for coverage that we have. One thing that we could do with that is to open that up to all ages. We say that the Affordable Care Act is so inefficient. If we had all ages going into Medicare, essentially by merging those plans, we would have a much broader and more solvent plan in that manner. That's an oversimplification of how that would have to work, but that's one thought.
Well, I'm going to jump in because that's a big thought. Medicare for all, Mark Goldwine, would that help? And can we afford that?
Sure. So I think something like a Medicare for all, it couldn't actually be a Medicare for all because it turns out Medicare's efficiencies don't scale as well as you think they would. But something like that, that was a single-payer program, I think is an interesting idea. It's also a really expensive one. And if we want to have a Medicare for all, we either need to all pay premiums for it or all pay a lot more in taxes. You know, during the campaign, Senator Sanders proposed a Medicare for all, and they proposed enough taxes they thought it would add up, and we looked at it, and it wasn't even close because they were trying to do it on the cheap. You can't get this with just a few percentage points payroll tax and then some taxes on higher earners. Medicare for all is a decision that we're going to pay less in private premiums, but in exchange, everybody's going to have to pay a lot more overall to the federal government.
Let's take another call from Cody in Appleton. Hi, Cody.
Hi. I guess just picking off where your last caller said, I also agree that we should have a single-payer system. And I think that going back to your previous point, talking about the military spending, I think we could actually reduce the military spending by something on the order of 50%. I'm a disabled military veteran, and I have a single-payer type system. I get free health care through the Veterans Administration, and it works great. And that is only 6% of our budget, while the military spending, the discretionary federal spending, is approaching 60% of our tax dollars. And I find it unconscionable that we would be discussing increasing military spending to go and fight wars all over this world. We have 800 military bases. We're in 70% of the countries around the world. And I find it unconscionable that we would be talking about that and not talking about how we can funnel that money into a single-payer system. Thank you.
A reaction to that, Mark?
So I think this is a really good point here, which is that the defense budget is one of our three largest programs, right after Social Security and Medicare. And the fact that we're not talking about any cuts to it, I think, is a little silly. There's certainly areas where we should be reducing military spending, reducing waste. Now, I do look at the overall top line of military, and I see that the sequestration is going to come back next year. So with no changes, there's actually already going to be a cut, and there doesn't seem to be support, frankly, among either party in Congress for that cut. So we need to figure out how to deal with that, and we need to remember that actually the military's largest and fastest-growing expenses are related to health care, are related to retirement. They're the same problems the rest of the federal government is facing. It's that we have an aging population and that we have rising health care costs. So ideally, we fix the health care problem, we fix the aging problem, we've reduced both of our military and our non-military spending and done so without making folks much worse off overall.
Well, let's shift gears just a bit to health care and the Affordable Care Act. Trump called on lawmakers from both parties to save America from this imploding Obamacare disaster, is how he put it. He seemed pretty much in step with House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republican leaders in that he would roll back mandatory coverage mandates, loosen federal standards for Medicaid. Talk some about how your group sees the repeal and replacement of Obamacare.
Yeah, it feels almost like there's no allowance for nuance when it comes to Obamacare. You know, on every issue you can say it's complicated, but in Obamacare, everyone is taking sides. And that's exactly backwards, because there's no such thing as the Obamacare program. What Obamacare is dozens, actually hundreds of different regulations, spending programs, tax adjustments, Medicare reductions, and new revenue programs. And they each have different effects. Some are good, some are bad, some are arguable but are necessary trade-offs. So what we really should be doing is not saying we like Obamacare or we don't like Obamacare, but saying which parts of Obamacare are working, which parts definitely are working, and which parts could be working better. Now, philosophically, Republicans have a little bit of a different vision of how to deliver care, and that's perfectly fine. And there's a mandate is one way to ensure people get coverage. There are other options, right? A income-based tax credit is one way. There's other options. So I don't think there's only one solution, and somehow Obamacare got the magic perfect one. But I also think this assumption that 100% of a very complicated piece of legislation is horrible is kind of silly, because Obamacare has many good things in it as well as many troubling aspects.
Your group said that a full repeal of Obamacare would leave only $750 billion to fund replacement legislation, and you doubt that's going to be enough?
Oh, that's right, because right now, between the Medicaid expansion and these insurance subsidies, we spend about $2 trillion. And that's funded with taxes, and it's funded with Medicare reductions that help to pay for it. If we got rid of the taxes and got rid of the subsidies, it would only leave us $750 billion. Now, I believe we could cover people more efficiently, so I think that we could cover the same amount of people for less than $2 trillion, but I find it hard to believe that we can get 2.5 times more efficient and cover that many people for $750 billion. So that leaves Republicans with three choices. Either they can cover far fewer people, they can find more money elsewhere to cover them, or they can decide that even though they don't like the taxes in Obamacare, we have to keep them until we find a way to replace them.
And because Obamacare is such a complicated issue, as Trump said, he said he would not be able to tackle tax reform until he knows how much the new health care program will cost. But he wants to cut taxes, you know, massive tax cuts for the middle class and corporations. Talk some about how comprehensive tax reform, how comprehensive should it be?
Sure. So President Trump and House Republicans are not totally in agreement on what tax reform should look like, but they both want to reduce the top individual rate from 39.6 down to 33. They both want to expand the standard deduction. So they both want to cut taxes for the rich and for the middle class. They both want to get rid of a lot of tax breaks, and they both want to cut the corporate rate pretty extensively, maybe to 15 or 20% from 35 today. All that's going to be really expensive. Okay, and you know, I'm an economist. Lower rates, especially lower rates on corporate income, which is capital income, are good for growth, but they are only good for growth if they don't add to the debt, if they are paid for by getting rid of tax breaks. Because if they add to the debt, all the good they do by encouraging investment is just going to go out the door the other side, because the debt is going to push away investment. And so I'm very worried that while they talk about tax reform, they'll find it easiest to just do tax cuts. And we already have, I mean, I'm going to give you some context. President Trump entered office with a higher debt as a share of the economy than any president in U.S. history, with the single exception of Harry Truman. And he's the only president that faces that high a debt that's also rising. To think that we can take that situation and add a $2, $3, $4, $5 trillion tax cut on top of it is just nuts.
He was saying, President Trump was saying, that the growth in the economy was going to help, was going to pay for this, essentially. That's not going to happen?
Well, it seems, A, like they want to earmark that same growth to pay for everything. If the growth is paying for the tax cuts, how can it also pay for the debt reduction and also pay for a spending plan? But B, we got to be realistic about growth. Economic growth, getting growth faster, is maybe the most important thing we can do, okay? Because higher growth means larger wages. It means higher income. It means stronger retirement accounts. And from a budgetary perspective, it means a more stable and healthy debt ratio, more better debt. But there's limits to what public policy can do. Traditionally, we've grown about 3% a year. Half of that has been driven by growth in the labor force. Now we have an aging population. Right now, you know, it used to be that we went from very few women in the labor force to women entering the labor force, but now most have entered. They're kind of at similar levels to men. So the potential for further labor force growth is relatively small. The Congressional Budget Office projects that instead of 1.5% labor force growth a year, we're only going to have 0.5% going forward. So that basically means, if you do the math on that, we were growing 3%, but now we're 1% down on labor force. It means we're only going to grow 2% a year over the next decade in the most likely scenario. Public policy maybe can get us up to 2.2 or 2.3, and that would be actually a really tremendous improvement that adds up a lot over 10 years, over 20 years. But there's no historic precedent for getting us to 4%, and there's only one historic precedent for getting us to the equivalent of 3%, which was the 60s. Other than the 60s, we've never gotten the type of productivity growth we would need to get to 3% economic growth.
We are talking budget issues, federal budget issues, with Mark Goldwine, who is with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He is reacting to what we know so far from the Trump administration about budget plans, including the increase in defense spending and the cutting of domestic programs, talking some about health care and Social Security and Medicare. When we come back from break, we'll talk some about infrastructure spending and other issues. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org after this news. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the Trump administration's first federal budget, and our guest is telling us what his group thinks that first budget should do. Our guest is Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We welcome your questions for him and your views, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's take a couple of calls before we move on to our next issue. Sarah in Lake Geneva is with us. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, good morning. I got a really good question. They're attacking all these entitlements and all these programs for the citizens. I'm wondering why they're not going after corporate subsidies, where they're spending $100 billion on corporate welfare, an average of $870 per family. And when I looked up further, and it says that the final totals of between corporate welfare and regular welfare, regular welfare is $59 billion, that's 3% of the federal budget for regular welfare, where corporate welfare is $92 billion, 5% of the total budget. How come we're not talking about that?
Yeah, and how do you define, well, actually I'll ask you, Mark, what is corporate welfare?
Of course, many government spending programs also have the effect, you know, you could argue they're corporate welfare because a lot of the money we spend goes through corporations, including on things like infrastructure and things like health care and stuff like that. Where I would say the first focus on corporate welfare should be is in the tax code. There are so many corporate tax breaks right now. And if it were me, my personal view is I would get rid of some of these tax breaks and put them in a deficit reduction. Now, I understand that in Congress, they want to get rid of these tax breaks and put it towards tax reform. That's an improvement versus where we are today. It's not as good as where I'd like to be. I'd also say, I'm not attacking these entitlement programs. I mean, we're not talking about welfare. We're talking about these broad programs that go to everybody, Social Security and Medicare mainly. And it's not that I'm attacking them, but if you look at the numbers, Social Security is spending about 25% more than it's bringing in revenue. And it's on its own. The trust fund is going to run out of money in 17 years. So we need to do something to save this. And I think if we act now, we can make gradual adjustments both to the benefits and to the tax base, getting people to pay more for their Social Security, and we can fix that program. Same thing on Medicare. It's the second largest, and it's the fastest growing part of the budget. And if we do thoughtful fixes, we can actually improve health care for everybody at the same time that we save money.
Yeah. What about her point that she said she found in her research that corporate welfare was 5% of the federal budget, whereas social welfare was just 2% of the federal budget? I'm not sure those numbers are exactly accurate, but what do you say about that?
So I think that's measuring a narrow measure of social welfare. That's mostly talking about things like temporary aid to needy families. And it's true that kind of that means test, those specific little welfare programs aren't very large, and it's not where we should be spending most of our attention. The biggest money, though, as I'll say it again, is in Social Security, mm-hmm. defense, Medicare, and Medicaid. Those are our four biggest programs in order. On the same time, this gets to the corporate welfare point, we spend about $1.6 trillion a year in tax breaks. Now, many of those tax breaks are really popular, things like the mortgage interest deduction and the charitable deduction, but I think we need to take a really hard look at these tax breaks and see which ones we can eliminate and which ones we can reform.
John in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you. Perhaps I didn't understand.
We're talking about the federal budget, John. What is your question or comment?
He mentioned the one-part system would be too expensive for taxpayers, if I understood correctly. But the taxpayers are already paying the insurance companies, who are doing quite well, including the top management folks, and the private industry does quite well. Why would it be too expensive for taxpayers when the taxpayers are already paying the private industry for those benefits, and they're doing quite well? Why should the one-payer system be too expensive when they're already paying the private entities for handling that?
Do you follow that, Mark?
This is a great question, right? So I did not say that single-payer would be too expensive for the taxpayers. What I said is it would be expensive. Right now, health care is really expensive through premiums. So it's a choice. We could choose to put health care over to the government and pay it all in taxes, We could choose to keep the current system where most of us get it through our employer, or we could choose something else. It's not that it's too expensive, but many people that are pitching single health care are trying to do it on the cheap, pretend that we can do it with just a couple of points payroll tax, and then high earners can pay for the rest. And every plan I've seen that's tried to do that has fallen way short. So it's not that it's too expensive. It's that we have to be realistic about these choices. Going from our current system to single payer doesn't mean that suddenly healthcare becomes free. It just means that we need to pay more taxes instead of more premiums to pay for it.
Well, in his address to Congress this week, President Trump asked lawmakers to approve a $1 trillion infrastructure bill, which would be paid for through public and private money. He also knocked the $6 trillion that America has spent in the Middle East, saying that we could have rebuilt our country multiple times with that amount. There's no firm proposal yet on this infrastructure rebuilding, but what's your philosophy on this public-private approach that apparently we're going toward?
Just a quick insta-fact check. The actual amount we've spent on the wars in the Middle East is still very expensive, but it's $2 trillion, not $6 trillion.
Okay.
Now, with that said, he said $6 trillion. With that said, as to the infrastructure, I think we need more of it. I think it's clear that we have places where bridges and roads are crumbling, and this is one of the best ways we can grow the economy. And I think getting the private sector involved for some of it makes sense. I think there's some pieces of infrastructure the private sector is never going to be interested in, but are important for the social good, so the government needs to be involved too. But I think doing a mix of direct government spending, public-private partnerships, maybe an infrastructure bank, I think that all of the above approach makes a lot of sense to me. What doesn't make sense to me is to think that we can borrow all the money on top of the massive debt that we already have in order to just build more infrastructure. We can't go back in time and undo the wars, right? But we can stop ourselves from continuing to add further to the debt by paying for it. For example, through a gas tax or through other kinds of fees or through repatriation money. There's lots of options out there. It seems to me economically the worst option would be to borrow all the money in order to pay for the infrastructure, because we'd basically be increasing public investment at the expense of reducing private investment.
Let's go to Bill in River Falls. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Joy. Thank you for taking my call. And your speaker basically answered my question about the infrastructure spending. But can we take it one step further? If you did go with the face value, $1 trillion infrastructure spending over 10 years, additional military spending, that per year spending, could that even be close to being covered by his proposed tax cuts, even if you eliminated some programs? And just as a comment, it sounds like President Trump's proposal and even the support of the Republicans is we're going to max out our credit card with the hope that we'll get a future raise, you know, when you're talking about paying for it with future growth. That's not an economic policy I teach my kids, and I certainly don't think it's an economic policy we should base our government on. But, yeah, I'll take my question off the air, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you for calling, Bill. Mark?
I don't even think I need to answer that, because the caller just got it. Bill, you just got it exactly right. The numbers don't add up, and there's some vague it's not like an investment that we're putting the credit card. It's like, I'll gladly take a hamburger today and pay you two tomorrow. We're making this vague promise of economic growth that we can't deliver on, and in exchange for that, we're asking for a $3 trillion down payment. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. So tell us what would be so bad about bonding or borrowing to $1 trillion to fix up our infrastructure? Why is that so dangerous?
Yeah, it's not the borrowing $1 trillion. It's the borrowing the $1 trillion on top of the $9 trillion that we're already projected to borrow, and the additional $2 trillion that we would have in tax cuts, and the additional $0.5 trillion we'd have in defense, and on top of the $15 trillion we currently hold. So the problem isn't this last trillion. It's that our debt is already the highest it has ever been, except under Harry Truman. And we cannot keep bringing it further. We need to start bringing it down, at least relative to the economy. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which is sort of the government official scorekeeper, they looked at the economic effects of infrastructure investment. And they basically found infrastructure that is paid for will grow the economy. But infrastructure that is not paid for will give a boost to the economy for 1 or 2 years and then shrink economic growth over time, because they find that the additional debt actually is going to do more harm then the infrastructure will do good.
So we talked about a lot of issues this hour, and I appreciate your time. But I know you also released this week, I believe, a paper on what you, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, would like to see in Trump's skinny budget. We can't go into everything, but what would you say is the most important thing that Trump's skinny budget should do?
So a president in his first term usually has kind of a miniature budget before the full budget. And we were hoping with this to have a skinny budget that would put the debt on a downward path with at least some level of detail. It sounds like we're going to get, I don't know what's thinner than skinny, but we're going to get just a frail budget that only includes his defense and non-defense numbers. That combined is only 30% of the budget, and I think is a mistake.
Yeah. I'm wondering if you have a brief comment. It's sort of self-serving, but I wonder what you have to say about cutting programs like the Arts and Humanities and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Right. So foreign aid is 1% of the budget. These are like 0.002% of the budget or something like that. It's not that every part of the budget, I believe, should be open to scrutiny and should have to justify itself every year. But to justify these as if they're going to be big budgetary savings measures, it just doesn't make sense because they're so small relative to what we're talking about spending on defense and on infrastructure and on tax cuts.
Yeah. And one final question. Some Republican lawmakers have said that Trump's budget plans are too deep in some cases and not deep enough in others, and that his budget is dead on arrival. Do you hope that's the case?
What I hope is that the president comes around to the idea that we're not going to be able to have massive tax cuts. We can have tax reform, but not tax cuts. We're going to pay for our infrastructure spending, and we're going to have to, over time, control the growth of our three largest programs, so four largest programs, I guess, Social Security, Medicare, Defense, and Medicaid. And if he does that, if he realizes that, I think next year's budget could look pretty good.
Thank you so much for being with us. Mark Goldwein is the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Thank you to Bill Martins and to Nyjah Ellison for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. We will talk about the upstarts in our next hour, Airbnb, Uber, and other companies like that. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.